found the hymn especially ominous. But as it was simply familiar, a frequent choice, probably because it was victorious in tone and squarely in that category of pilgrimage and conflict, which is often so inspiring to young men. The Son of God goes forth to war, a kingly crown to gain. His blood-red banner streams afar. Who follows in his train? Who best can drink his cup of woe, triumphant over pain? Who, patient, bears his cross below? He follows in his train. It was a hymn that Owen liked, and we belted it out. We sang much more heartily, much more defiantly than usual. The headmaster had nowhere to stand. He occupied the center stage, but with nothing to stand behind, he looked exposed and unsure of himself. As we roared out the hymn, the Reverend Lewis Merrill appeared to gain in confidence, and even in stature. Although he didn't look exactly comfortable beside the headless Mary Magdalene, he stood so close to her that the podium light shone on him, too. When we finished the hymn, the Reverend Mr. Merrill said, "Let us pray." "Let us pray for Owen Meany," he said. It was very quiet in the great hall, and although our heads were bowed, our eyes were on the headmaster. We waited for Mr. Merrill to begin. Perhaps he was trying to begin, I thought. Then I realized that, awkward as ever, he had meant for us to pray for Owen. What he'd meant was that we were to offer our silent prayers for Owen Meany. And as the silence went on and on, it became clear that the Reverend Lewis Merrill had no intention of hurrying us. He was not a brave man, I thought, but he was trying to be brave. On and on, we prayed and prayed. And if I had known about Owen's dream, I would have prayed much harder. Suddenly, the headmaster said, "That's enough." "I'm sorry," Mr. Merrill stuttered, "but I'll say when it's enough." I think that was when the headmaster realized he had lost. He realized then that he was finished. Because what could he do? Was he going to tell us to stop praying? We kept our heads bowed, and we kept praying. Even as awkward as he was, the Reverend Mr. Merrill had made it clear to us that there was no end to praying for Owen Meany. After a while, Randy White left the stage. He had the good sense, if not the decency, to leave quietly. We could hear his careful footsteps on the marble staircase, and the morning ice was still so brittle that we could even hear him crunching his way on the path outside the main academy building. When we could no longer hear his footsteps in our silent prayers for Owen Meany, Pastor Merrill said, "Amen." Oh, God, how often I have wished that I could relive that moment. I didn't know how to pray very well then. I didn't even believe in prayer. If I were given the opportunity to pray for Owen Meany now, I could do a better job of it. Knowing what I know now, I might be able to pray hard enough. It would have helped me, of course, if I could have seen his diary, but he wasn't offering it. He was keeping his diary to himself. So often in its pages he had written his name, his full name, in the big block letters he called
"Monument Style"
or
"Gravesend Lettering."
So many times he had transcribed in his diary his name exactly the way he had seen it on Scrooge's grave. And I mean, before all the ROTC business, even before he was thrown out of school and knew that the U.S. Army would be his ticket through college. I mean, before he knew he was signing up. Even then, he had written his name in that way you see names inscribed on graves. First Lieutenant Paul O. Meany, Jr. That's how he wrote it. That was what the ghost of the future had seen on Scrooge's grave. That and the date. The date was written in the diary, too. He wrote the date in the diary many, many times, but he never told me what it was. Maybe I could have helped him, if I'd known that date. Owen believed he knew when he was going to die. He also believed he knew his rank. He would die a first lieutenant. And after the dream, he believed he knew more. The certainty of his convictions was always a little scary, and his diary entry about the dream is no exception.
Yesterday, I was kicked out of school. Last night, I had a dream. Now I know four things. I know that my voice doesn't change, but I still don't know why. I know that I am God's instrument. I know when I'm going to die. And now a dream has shown me how I'm going to die. I'm going to be a hero. I trust that God will help me, because what I'm supposed to do looks very hard.
Chapter 8. The Finger. Until the summer of 1962, I felt that I couldn't wait to grow up and be treated with the kind of respect I imagined adults were routinely offered and adamantly thought they deserved. I couldn't wait to wallow in the freedom and the privileges I imagined grown-ups enjoyed. Until that summer, my long apprenticeship to maturity struck me as arduous and humiliating. Randy White had confiscated my fake draft card, and I wasn't yet old enough to buy beer. I wasn't independent enough to merit my own place to live, I wasn't earning enough to afford my own car, and I wasn't something enough to persuade a woman to bestow her sexual favors upon me. Not one woman had I ever persuaded. Until the summer of 62, I thought that childhood and adolescence were a purgatory without apparent end. I thought that youth, in a word, sucked. But Owen Meany, who believed he knew when and how he was going to die, was in no hurry to grow up. And as to my calling the period of our youth a purgatory, Owen said simply,
"There is no purgatory. That's a Catholic invention. There's life on earth, there's heaven, and there's hell."
"I think life on earth is hell," I said.
"I hope you have a nice summer," Owen said.
It was the first summer we spent apart. I suppose I should be grateful for that summer, because it afforded me my first glimpse of what my life without Owen would be like. You might say it prepared me. By the end of the summer of 1962, Owen Meany had made me afraid of what the next phase was going to be. I didn't want to grow up anymore. What I wanted was for Owen and me to go on being kids for the rest of our lives. Sometimes Canon Mackey tells me, rather ungenerously, that I have succeeded. Canon Campbell, God rest his soul, used to tell me that being a kid for the rest of my life was a perfectly honorable aspiration. I spent that summer of 62 in Sawyer Depot, working for my Uncle Alfred. After what had happened to Owen, I didn't want to work for the Gravesend Academy admissions office and give guided tours of the school. Not anymore. The Eastman Lumber Company offered me a good job. It was tiring outdoor work, but I got to spend my time with Noah and Simon, and there were parties on Loveless Lake almost every night, and swimming and water skiing on Loveless Lake nearly every day, after work and every weekend. Uncle Alfred and Aunt Martha welcomed me into the family. They gave me Hester's room for the summer. Hester was keeping her school year apartment in Durham, working as a waitress in one of those sandy lobster house restaurants. I think it was in Kittery or Portsmouth. After she got off work, she and Owen would cruise the strip at Hampton Beach in the tomato red pickup. Hester's school year roommates were elsewhere for the summer, and Hester and Owen spent every night in her Durham apartment, alone. They were living together as man and wife. That was the disapproving and frosty way Aunt Martha put it, when she discussed it at all, which was rarely. Despite the fact that Owen and Hester were living together as man and wife, Noah and Simon and I could never be sure if they were actually doing it. Simon was sure that Hester could not live without doing it. Noah somehow felt that Owen and Hester had done it, but that for some special reason they had stopped. I had the strangest feeling that anything between them was possible, that they did it and had always done it with abandon, that they had never done it, but that they might be doing something even worse, or better, and that the real bond between them, whether they did it or not, was even more passionate and far sadder than sex. I felt cut off from Owen. I was working with wood and smelling a cool northern air that was scented with trees. He was working with granite and feeling the sun beat down on the unshaded quarry, inhaling the rock dust and smelling the dynamite. Chainsaws were relatively new then. The Eastman Company used them for their logging operations, but very selectively. They were heavy and cumbersome, not nearly so light and powerful as they are today. In those days, we brought the logs out of the woods by horse and crawler tractor, and the timber was often cut by cross-cut saws and axes. We loaded the logs onto the trucks by hand, using peavies or cant dogs. Nowadays, Noah and Simon have shown me, they use self-loading trucks, grapple skidders, and chippers. Even the sawmill has changed. There's no more sawdust. But in 62, we debarked the logs at the mill and sawed them into various grades and sizes of lumber, and all that bark and sawdust was wasted. Nowadays, Noah and Simon refer to that stuff as wood-fired waste or even energy. They use it to make their own electricity. "How's that for progress?" Simon is always saying. Now we're the grown-ups we were in such a hurry to become. Now we can drink all the beer we want, with no one asking us for proof of our age. Noah and Simon have their own houses, their own wives and children, and they do an admirable job of looking after old Uncle Alfred and my Aunt Martha, who is still a lovely woman, although she's quite gray. She looks much the way Grandmother looked to me in the summer of 62. Uncle Alfred's had two bypass operations, but he's doing fine. The Eastman Company has provided him and my Aunt Martha with a good and long life. My aunt manifests only the most occasional vestige of her old interest in who my actual father is or was. Last Christmas, in Sawyer Depot, she managed to get me alone for a second, and she said, "Do you still not know? You can tell me. I'll bet you know. How could you not have found out something in all this time?" I put my finger to my lips, as if I were going to tell her something that I didn't want Uncle Alfred or Dan or Noah or Simon to hear. Aunt Martha grew very attentive, her eyes sparkling, her smile widening with mischief and conspiracy. "Dan Needham is the best father a boy could have," I whispered to her. "I know. Dan is wonderful," Aunt Martha said impatiently. This was not what she wanted to hear. And what do Noah and Simon and I still talk about after all these years? We talk about what Owen knew, or thought he knew, and we talk about Hester. We'll talk about Hester in our graves. "Hester the molester," Simon says. "Who would have thought any of it possible?" Noah asks. And every Christmas, Uncle Alfred or Aunt Martha will say, "I believe that Hester will be home for Christmas next year. That's what she says." And Noah and Simon will say, "That's what she always says." I suppose that Hester is my aunt and uncle's only unhappiness. Even in the summer of 62, I felt this was true. They treated her differently from the way they treated Noah and Simon, and she made them pay for it. How angry they made her. She took her anger away from Sawyer Depot, and everywhere she went, she found other things and people to fuel her colossal anger. I don't think Owen was angry, not exactly, but they shared a sense of some unfairness. There was an atmosphere of injustice that enveloped them both. Owen felt that God had assigned him a role that he was powerless to change. Owen's sense of his own destiny, his belief that he was on a mission, robbed him of his capacity for fun. In the summer of 62, he was only 20, but from the moment he was told that Jack Kennedy was diddling Marilyn Monroe, he stopped doing anything for pleasure. Esther was just plain pissed off. She just didn't give a shit. They were such a depressing couple. But in the summer of 62, I thought my Aunt Martha and Uncle Alfred were a perfect couple. And yet they depressed me because of how happy they were. In their happiness, they reminded me of the brief time my mother and Dan Needham had been together, and how happy they'd been, too. Meanwhile, that summer, I couldn't manage to have a successful date. Noah and Simon did everything they could for me. They introduced me to every girl on Loveless Lake. It was a summer of wet bathing suits drying from the radio aerial of Noah's car, and the closest I came to sex was the view I had of the crotches of various girls' bathing suits snapping in the wind that whipped past Noah's car. It was a convertible, a black-and-white 57 Chevy, the kind of car that had fins. Noah would let me take it to the drive-in, if and when I managed to get a date. "How was the movie?" Noah would always ask me, when I brought the car home, always much too early. "He looks like he saw every minute of it," Simon would say. And I had. I saw every minute of every movie I took every girl to. And more's the shame. Noah and Simon created countless opportunities for me to be alone with various dates at the Eastman Boathouse. At night, that boathouse had the reputation of a cheap motel, but all I ever managed was a long game of darts, or sometimes my date and I would sit on the dock, withholding any comment on the spectacle of the hard and distant stars until, finally, Noah or Simon would arrive to rescue us from our awkward torment. I started feeling afraid, for no reason I could understand. Georgian Bay, July 25, 1987. It's a shame you can buy the Globe and Mail and the Toronto Star in Pointe aux Barils station, but thank God they don't carry the New York Times. The island in Georgian Bay that has been in Catherine Keeling's family since 1933, when Catherine's grandfather reputedly won it in a poker game, is about a 15-minute boat ride from Pointe aux Barils station. The island is in the vicinity of Burnt Island and Heart's Content Island and Pisay Point. I think it's called Gibson Island or Ormsby Island. There are both Gibsons and Ormsbys in Catherine's family. I believe that Gibson was Catherine's maiden name, but I forget. Anyway, there are a bunch of notched cedarwood cottages on the island, which is not served by electric power, but is comfortably and efficiently supplied with propane gas. The refrigerators, the hot water heater, the stoves, and the lamps are all run on propane. The tanks of gas are delivered to the island by boat. The island has its own septic system, which is a subject often discussed by the hordes of Keelings and Gibsons and Ormsbys who empty themselves into it and who are fearful of the system's eventual rebellion. I would not have wanted to visit the Keelings or the Gibsons or the Ormsbys on their island before the septic system was installed, but that period of unlighted encounters with spiders in outhouses and various late-night frights in the privy world is another favorite topic of discussion among the families who share the island each summer. I have heard many times the story of Uncle Bulwer Ormsby, who was attacked by an owl in the privy, which had no door, the better to air it out, the Keelings and the Gibsons and the Ormsbys all claimed. Uncle Bulwer was pecked on top of his head during a fortunate hiatus in what should have been a most private action, and he was so fearful of the attacking owl that he had fled the privy with his pants down at his ankles and did even greater injury to himself, greater than the owl's injury, by running headfirst into a pine tree. And every year that I visited the island, there are the familiar disputes regarding what kind of owl it was, or even if it was an owl. Catherine's husband, Charlie Keeling, says it was probably a horsefly or a moth. Others say it was surely a screech owl, for they are known to be fierce in the defense of their nests, even to the extent of attacking humans. Others say that a screech owl's range does not extend to Georgian Bay, and that it was surely a merlin, a pigeon hawk. They are very aggressive, and are often mistaken for the smaller owls at night. The company of Catherine's large and friendly family is comforting to me. The conversations tend toward legendary occurrences on the island, many of which include acts of bravery or cowardice from the old outhouse or privy period of their lives. Disputed encounters with nature are also popular. My days here are most enjoyably spent in identifying species of bird and mammal and fish and reptile and, unfortunately, insect, almost none of which is well known to me. Was that an otter or a mink or a muskrat? Was that a loon or a duck or a scoter? Does it sting or bite, or is it poisonous? These distinctions are punctuated by more direct questions to the children. Did you flush? Turn off the gas, close the screen door, leave the water running. The pump is run by a gasoline engine. And did you hang up your bathing suit and towel where they will dry? It is remindful to me of my Loveless Lake days, without the agony of dating. And Loveless Lake is a dinky pond compared to Georgian Bay. Even in the summer of 62, Loveless Lake was overrun by motorboats, and in those days many summer cottages flushed their toilets directly into the lake. The so-called great outdoors is so much greater and so much nicer in Canada than it ever was, in my time, in New Hampshire. But pine pitch on your fingers is the same everywhere. And the kids with their hair damp all day and their wet bathing suits and someone always with a skinned knee or a splinter and the sound of bare feet on a dock and the quarreling, all the quarreling. I love it. For a short time, it is very soothing. I can almost imagine that I have had a life very different from the life I have had. One can learn much through the thin walls of summer houses. For example, I once heard Charlie Keeling tell Catherine that I was a non-practicing homosexual. "What does that mean?" Catherine asked him. I held my breath. I strained to hear Charlie's answer. For years, I've wanted to know what it means to be a non-practicing homosexual. "You know what I mean, Catherine," Charlie said.
"You mean he doesn't do it," Catherine said.
"I believe he doesn't," Charlie said.
"But when he thinks about doing it with men?" Catherine asked.
"I believe he doesn't think about it at all," Charlie answered.
"Then in what way is he homosexual, Charlie?" Catherine asked.
Charlie sighed. In summer houses, one can even hear the sighs. "He's not unattractive," Charlie said. "He doesn't have a girlfriend. Has he ever had a girlfriend?"
"I fail to see how this makes him gay," Catherine said. "He doesn't seem gay. Not to me."
"I didn't say he was gay," Charlie said. "A non-practicing homosexual doesn't always know what he is."
So that's what it means to be a non-practicing homosexual, I thought. It means I don't know what I am.
Every day, there is a discussion of what we will eat, and who will take the boat or one of the boats to the station to fetch the food and the vitals. The shopping list is profoundly basic. Gasoline, batteries, band-aids, corn, if any, insect repellent, hamburger and buns, lots, eggs, milk, flour, butter, beer, lots, fruit, if any, bacon, tomatoes, clothespins, for Prue, lemons, live bait. I let the younger children show me how they have learned to drive the boat. I let Charlie Keeling take me fishing. I really enjoy fishing for smallmouth bass, one day a year. I lend a hand to whatever the most pressing project on the island is. The Ormsbys need to rebuild their deck. The Gibsons are replacing shingles on the boathouse roof. Every day, I volunteer to be the one to go to the station. Shopping for a large family is a treat for me. For such a short time. I take a kid or two with me, for the pleasure of driving the boat would be wasted on me, and I always share my room with one of the Keeling children, or rather, the child is required to share his room with me. I fall asleep, listening to the astonishing complexity of a child breathing in his sleep, of a loon crying out on the dark water, of the waves lapping the rocks onshore. And in the morning, long before the child stirs, I hear the gulls and I think about the tomato red pickup cruising the coastal road between Hampton Beach and Rye Harbor. I hear the raucous, embattled crows whose shrill disputations and harangues remind me that I have awakened in the real world, in the world I know, after all. For a moment, until the crows commence their harsh bickering, I can imagine that here on Georgian Bay, I have found what was once called the New World, all over again. I have stumbled ashore on the undamaged land that Wadahantuit sold to my ancestor. For in Georgian Bay, it is possible to imagine North America as it was, before the United States began the murderous deceptions and the unthinking carelessness that have all but spoiled it. Then I hear the crows. They bring me back to the world with their sounds of mayhem. I try not to think about Owen. I try to talk with Charlie Keeling about otters. They have a long, flattened tail. The tail lies horizontally on the water, Charlie told me. I see, I said. We were sitting on the rocks, on that part of the shoreline where one of the children said he'd seen a muskrat. It was an otter, Charlie told the child.
You didn't see it, Dad,
another of the children said. So Charlie and I decided to wait the creature out. A lot of freshwater clam shells marked the entrance to the animal's cave and the rocks on shore. An otter is a lot faster in the water than a muskrat, Charlie told me. I see, I said. We sat for an hour or two, and Charlie told me how the water level of Georgian Bay, and of all of Lake Huron, was changing. Every year it changes. He said he was worried that the acid rain from the United States was starting to kill the lake, beginning, as it always does, he said, with the bottom of the food chain. I see, I said. The weeds have changed. The algae have changed. You can't catch the pike you used to. And one otter hasn't killed all these clams, he said, indicating the shells. I see, I said. Then, when Charlie was peeing, in the bush, as Canadians say, an animal about the size of a small beagle, with a flattened sort of head and dark brown fur, swam out from the shore. Charlie, I called. The animal dove. It did not come up again. One of the children was instantly beside me.
What is it?
The child asked. I don't know, I said. Did it have a flattened tail? Charlie called from the bush. It had a flattened sort of head, I said.
That's a muskrat,
one of the children said.
You didn't see it,
said his sister. What kind of tail did it have? Charlie called. I didn't see its tail, I admitted. It was that fast, huh? Charlie asked me, emerging from the bush, zipping up his fly. It was pretty fast, I guess, I said. It was an otter, he said. I am tempted to say it was a non-practicing homosexual, but I don't.
See the duck?
A little girl asked me.
That was no duck, you fool,
her brother said.
You didn't see it. It dove,
the girl said.
It was a female something,
someone else said.
Oh, what do you know?
Another child said. I didn't see anything, I said. Look over there. Just keep looking, Charlie Keeling said to me. It has to come up for air, he explained. It's probably a pintail, or a mallard, or a blue-winged teal, if it's a female, he said. The pines smell wonderful, and the lichen on the rocks smell wonderful. And even the smell of fresh water is wonderful. Or is it, really, the smell of some organic rot that is carrying on just under the surface of all that water? I don't know what makes a lake smell that way, but it's wonderful. I could ask the Keeling family to tell me why the lake smells that way, but I prefer the silence. Just the breeze that's almost constant in the pines, the lap of the waves and the gulls' cries and the shrieks of the terns.
That's a Caspian tern,
one of the Keeling boys said to me.
See the long red bill? See the black feet?
I see, I said. But I wasn't paying attention to the tern. I was remembering the letter I wrote to Owen Meany in the summer of 1962. Dan Needham had told me that he had seen Owen one Sunday in the Gravesend Academy gym. Dan said that Owen had the basketball, but he wasn't shooting. He was standing at the foul line, just looking up at the basket. He wasn't even dribbling the ball, and he wouldn't take a shot. Dan said it was the strangest thing. "He was just standing there," Dan said. "I must have watched him for 5 minutes, and he didn't move a muscle. He just held the ball and stared at the basket. He's so small, you know. The basket must look like it's a mile away." "He was probably thinking about the shot," I told Dan. "Well, I didn't bother him," Dan said. "Whatever he was thinking about, he was concentrating so hard he didn't see me. I didn't even say hello. I don't think he would have heard me anyway," Dan said. Hearing about him made me even miss practicing that stupid shot. And so I wrote to him, just casually. Since when would a 20-year-old actually come out and say he missed his best friend? "Dear Owen," I wrote him, "what are you up to? It's kind of boring here. I like the work in the woods best, I mean the logging, except there are deer flies. The work at the sawmill and in the lumber yards is much hotter, but there are no deer flies. Uncle Alfred insists that Loveless Lake is potable. He says we have swallowed so much of it we would be dead if it weren't. But Noah says there's much more piss and shit in it than there is in the ocean. I miss the beach. How's the beach this summer? Maybe next summer your father would give me a job in the quarries." He wrote back. He didn't bother to begin with the usual, "Dear John." The voice had his own style. Nothing fancy, strictly capitals.
"Are you crazy?" Owen wrote me. "You want to work in the quarries? You think it's hot in a lumberyard? My father doesn't do a lot of hiring, and I'm sure he won't pay you as much as your Uncle Alfred. It sounds to me like you haven't met the right girl up there."
"So how's Hester?" I asked him when I wrote him back. "Be sure to tell her that I love her room. That'll piss her off. I don't suppose she's been helping you practice the shot. If you lose your touch, that'll be too bad. You were so close to doing it in under 3 seconds." He wrote back immediately.
"Under 3 seconds is definitely possible. I haven't been practicing, but thinking about it is almost as good. My father will hire you next summer. It won't be too bad if you start out slowly, maybe in the monument shop. By the way, the beach has been great. Lots of good-looking girls around, and Caroline O'Day has been asking about you. You ought to see how she looks when she's not wearing her St. Michael's uniform. Saw Dan on his bicycle. He should lose a little weight. And Hester and I spent an evening with your grandmother. We watched the Idiot Box, of course, and you should have heard your grandmother on the subject of the Geneva Conference. She said she'd believe in the neutrality of Laos when the Soviets decided to relocate on the moon. She said she'd believe in the Geneva Accords when there was nothing but parrots and monkeys moving along the Ho Chi Minh Trail. I won't repeat what Hester said about you using her room. It's the same thing she says about her mother and father and Noah and Simon and all the girls on Loveless Lake, so perhaps you're familiar with the expression?"
I wrote a letter to Caroline O'Day. She never answered me. It was August 1962. I remember one very hot day, humid with a hazy sky. A thunderstorm was threatening, but it never came. It was very much like the day of my mother's wedding, before the storm. It was what Owen Meany and I called typical Gravesend weather. Noah and Simon and I were logging. The deer flies were driving us crazy, and there were mosquitoes, too. Simon was the easiest to drive crazy. Of the three of us, the deer flies and mosquitoes liked Simon the best. Logging is most dangerous if you're impatient. Saws and axes, peavies and cat dogs, these tools belong in patient hands. Simon got a little sloppy and reckless with his cat dog. He chased after a deer fly with the hook end and speared himself in the calf. It was a deep gash, about 3 or 4 inches long, not serious, but he would require some stitches to close the wound and a tetanus shot. Noah and I were elated. Even Simon, who had a high tolerance for pain, was pretty pleased. The injury meant we could all get out of the woods. We drove the Jeep out the logging road to Noah's Chevy. We took the Chevy out on the highway through Sawyer Depot and Conway to the emergency entrance of the North Conway Hospital. There'd been an automobile accident somewhere near the main border, so Simon rated a low priority in the emergency room. That was fine with all of us, because the longer it took for Simon to get his tetanus shot and his stitches, the longer we would be away from the deer flies and the mosquitoes and the heat. Simon even pretended not to know if he was allergic to anything. Aunt Martha and Uncle Alfred had to be called, and that took more time. Noah started flirting with one of the nurses. With any luck, Noah knew, we could fart around the whole rest of the day and never go back to work. One of the less mangled victims of the auto accident sat in the waiting room with us. He was someone Noah and Simon knew vaguely, a type not uncommon in the North Country, one of those ski bums who don't seem to know what to do with themselves when there isn't any snow. This was a guy who'd been drinking a bottle of beer when one car hit another. He'd been the driver of one of the cars, he said, and the bottleneck had broken in his mouth on impact. He had lacerations on the roof of his mouth, and his gums were slashed, and the broken neck of the bottle had pierced his cheek. He proudly showed us the lacerations inside his mouth and the hole in his cheek, all the while mopping up his mouth and face with a blood-soaked wad of gauze, which he periodically wrung out in a blood-soaked towel. He was precisely the sort of North Country lunatic who gave Hester great disdain for Sawyer Depot and led her to maintain her residence in the college community of Durham year-round.
"Did you hear about Marilyn Monroe?" the ski bum asked us.
We were prepared for a dirty joke, an absolutely filthy joke. The ski bum's smile was a bleeding gash in his face. His smile was the repulsive equal to his gaping wound in his cheek. He was lascivious, depraved. Our much-appreciated holiday in the emergency room had taken a nasty turn. We tried to ignore him.
"Did you hear about Marilyn Monroe?" he asked us again.
Suddenly it didn't sound like a joke. Maybe it's about the Kennedys, I thought. "No, what about her?" I said.
"She's dead," the ski bum said.
He took such a sadistic pleasure in his announcement. His smile appeared to pump the blood out of his mouth and the hole in his cheek. I thought that he was as pleased by the shock value of what he had to say as he was thrilled by the spectacle of wringing his own blood from the sodden gauze pad into the sodden towel. Forever after, I would see his bleeding face whenever I imagined how Larry Lish and his mother must have responded to this news. How eagerly, how greedily they must have spread the word. "Have you heard? You mean you haven't heard?" The rapture of so much amateur conjecturing and surmising would flush their faces as irrepressibly as blood.
"How?" I asked the ski bum.
"An overdose," he said.
He sounded disappointed, as if he'd been hoping for something bloodier.
"Maybe it was an accident. Maybe it was suicide," he said.
Maybe it was the Kennedys, I thought. It made me feel afraid. At first that summer it was something vague that had made me feel afraid. Now something concrete made me feel afraid. But my fear itself was still vague. What could Marilyn Monroe's death ever have to do with me?
"It has to do with all of us,"
said Owen Meany when I called in that night.
"She was just like our whole country. Not quite young anymore, but not old either. A little breathless, very beautiful, maybe a little stupid, maybe a lot smarter than she seemed. And she was looking for something. I think she wanted to be good. Look at the men in her life. Joe DiMaggio, Arthur Miller, maybe the Kennedys. Look at how good they seem. Look at how desirable she was. That's what she was. She was desirable. She was funny and sexy, and she was vulnerable, too. She was never quite happy. She was always a little overweight. She was just like our whole country," he repeated.
He was on a roll. I could hear Hester playing her guitar in the background as if she were trying to improvise a folk song from everything he said.
"And those men," he said, "those famous, powerful men, did they really love her? Did they take care of her? If she was ever with the Kennedys, they couldn't have loved her. They were just using her. They were just being careless and treating themselves to a thrill. That's what powerful men do to this country. It's a beautiful, sexy, breathless country, and powerful men use it to treat themselves to a thrill. They say they love it, but they don't mean it. They say things to make themselves appear good. They make themselves appear moral. That's what I thought Kennedy was, a moralist. But he was just giving us a snow job. He was just being a good seducer. I thought he was a savior. I thought he wanted to use his power to do good. But people will say and do anything just to get the power. Then they'll use the power just to get a thrill. Marilyn Monroe was always looking for the best man. Maybe she wanted the man with the most integrity. Maybe she wanted the man with the most ability to do good. And she was seduced over and over again. She got fooled. She was tricked. She got used. She was used up. Just like the country. The country wants a savior. The country is a sucker for powerful men who look good. We think they're moralists, and then they just use us. That's what's going to happen to you and me, said Owen Meany. We're going to be used.
Georgian Bay, July 26, 1987. The Toronto Star says that President Reagan actually led the first efforts to conceal essential details of his secret Arms for Hostages program and keep it alive after it became public. The Toronto Star added that the president subsequently made misleading statements about the arms sales on four separate occasions. Owen used to say that the most disturbing thing about the anti-war movement against the Vietnam War was that he suspected self-interest motivated many of the protesters. He thought that if the issue of many of the protesters being drafted was removed from the issue of the war, there would be very little protest at all. Look at the United States today. Are they drafting young Americans to fight in Nicaragua? No, not yet. Are masses of young Americans outraged at the Reagan administration's shoddy and deceitful behavior? Ho-hum, not hardly. I know what Owen Meany would say about that. I know what he did say, and it still applies.
The only way you can get Americans to notice anything is to tax them or draft them or kill them, Owen said.
He said that once, when Hester proposed abolishing the draft.
If you abolish the draft, said Owen Meany, most Americans will simply stop caring about what we're doing in other parts of the world.
I saw a mink run under the boathouse today. It had such a slender body. It was only slightly larger than a weasel, with a weasel's undulating movement. It had such a thick, glossy coat of fur. I was instantly reminded of Larry Lish's mother. Where is she now? I wondered. I know where Larry Lish is. He's a well-known journalist in New York. An investigative reporter is what he's called. I've read a few of his pieces. They're not bad. He was always clever. And I noticed that he's acquired a necessary quality in his voice. Necessary, I think, if a journalist is going to make a name for himself and gain an audience and so forth. Larry Lish has become particularly self-righteous, and the quality in his voice that I call necessary is a tone of moral indignation. Larry Lish has become a moralist. Imagine that. I wonder what his mother has become. If she got the right guy to marry her before it was too late, maybe Mitzi Lish has become a moralist, too. In the fall of 62, when Owen Meany and I began our life as freshmen at the University of New Hampshire, we enjoyed certain advantages that set us apart from our lowly, less experienced peers. We were not subject to dormitory rules because we lived at home. We were commuters from Gravesend and were permitted to park our own means of transportation on campus, which other freshmen were not allowed to do. I divided my at-home time between Dan and my grandmother. This had an added advantage in that when there was a late-night university party in Durham, I could tell Dan I was staying with my grandmother and tell grandmother I was staying with Dan and never come home. Owen was not required to be home at any special time. Considering that he spent every night of the summer at Hester's apartment, I was surprised that he was going through the motions of living at home at all. Hester's roommates were back, however. If Owen stayed at Hester's, there was no question regarding the bed in which he spent the night. Whether he and Hester did it or not, they were at least familiar with the intimate proximity that Hester's queen-size mattress forced upon them. But once our classes began, Owen didn't sleep at Hester's apartment more than once or twice a week. Our other advantages over our fellow freshmen were several. We had suffered the academic rigors of Gravesend Academy. The coursework at the University of New Hampshire was very easy in comparison. I benefited greatly from this because, as Owen had taught me, I chiefly needed to give myself more time to do the work assigned. So much less work was assigned than what I had learned to expect from the academy that, for once, I had ample time. I got good grades, almost easily. And for the first time, although this took 2 or 3 years, I began to think of myself as smart. But the relatively undemanding expectations of the university had quite a different effect on Owen Meany. He could do everything he was asked without half trying, and this made him lazy. He quickly fell into a habit of getting no better grades than he needed to satisfy his ROTC scholarship. To my surprise, his best grades were always in the ROTC courses, in so-called military science. We took many of the same classes. In English and history, I actually got better grades than Owen. The voice had become indifferent about his writing.
"I am developing a minimalist style," he told our English teacher, who'd complained that Owen never expanded a single point in any of his papers. He never employed more than one example for each point he made. "First you tell me I can't write using only capital letters. Now you want me to elaborate, to be more expansive. Is that consistent?" he asked our English teacher. "Maybe you want me to change my personality, too."
If, at Gravesend Academy, the voice had persuaded the majority of the faculty that his eccentricities and peculiarities were not only his individual rights, but were inseparable from his generally acknowledged brilliance, the more diverse but also more specialized faculty at the University of New Hampshire were not interested in the whole boy. Not at all. They were not even a community, the university faculty, and they shared no general opinion that Owen Meany was brilliant. They expressed no general concern that his individual rights needed protection, and they had no tolerance for eccentricities and peculiarities. The classes they taught were for no student's special development. Their interests were the subject themselves. Their passions were for the politics of the university or of their own departments within it, and their overall view of us students was that we should conform ourselves to their methods of their disciplines of study. Owen Meany, who had been so conspicuous all my life, was easily overlooked at the University of New Hampshire. He was in none of his classes as distinguished as the tomato red pickup, which was so readily distinguishable among the many economy model cars that most parents bought for most students who had their own cars. My grandmother had bought me a Volkswagen Beetle. In the campus parking lots, there were so many VWs of the same year and navy blue color that I could identify mine only by its license plate or by the familiarity of whatever I had left on the back seat. And although Owen and I first counted Hester's friendship as an advantage, her friendship was another means by which Owen Meany became lost in Durham. Hester had a lot of friends among the seniors in what was our first year. These seniors were the people Owen and I hung out with. We didn't have to make any friends among the freshmen, and when Hester and her friends graduated, Owen and I didn't have any friends. As for whatever had made me feel afraid in the summer of 62, Whatever that fear was, it was replaced by a kind of solitariness, a feeling of being oddly set apart, but without loneliness. The loneliness would come later. And as for fear, you would have thought the Cuban Missile Crisis, that October, would have sufficed. You would have thought that would have scared the shit out of us, as people in New Hampshire are always untruthfully claiming. But Owen said to Hester and me, and to a bunch of hangers-on in Hester's apartment,
"Don't be afraid. This is no big deal. This is just a bit of nuclear bluffing. Nothing happens as a result of this. Believe me, I know."
What he meant was that he believed he knew what would happen to him, that it wasn't missiles that would get him, neither the Soviets nor ours, and that whatever it was, it didn't happen in October 1962. "How do you know nothing's going to happen?" someone asked him. It was the guy who hung around Hester's apartment, as if he were waiting for Owen Meany to drop dead. He kept encouraging Hester to read the Alexandria Quartet, especially Justine and Clea, which this guy claimed he had read 4 or 5 times. Hester wasn't much of a reader, and I had read only Justine. Owen Meany had read the whole quartet, and had told Hester and me not to bother with the last 3 novels.
"It's just more of the same, and not so well done," Owen said. "One book about having sex in a foreign atmosphere is enough."
"What do you know about sex in a foreign atmosphere?" the quartet lover had asked Owen. Owen had not answered the guy. He surely knew the guy was a rival for Hester's affections. He also knew that rivals are best unmanned by being ignored. "Hey," the guy shouted at Owen, "I'm talking to you. What makes you think you know there's not going to be a war?"
"Oh, there's going to be a war, all right," said Owen Meany. "But not now. Not over Cuba. Either Khrushchev will pull the missiles out of Cuba, or Kennedy will offer him something to help him save face."
"This little man knows everything," the guy said.
"Don't you call him little," Hester said. "He's got the biggest penis ever. If there's a bigger one, I don't want to know about it," Hester said.
"There's no need to be crude," said Owen Meany.
That was the last we ever saw of the guy who wanted Hester to read the Alexandria Quartet. I will confess that in the showers in the Gravesend Academy gym, after practicing the shot, I had noticed that Owen's doink was especially large. At least it was disproportionately large. Compared to the rest of him, it was huge. My cousin Simon, whose doink was rather small, perhaps owing to Hester's childhood violence upon it, once claimed that small doinks grew much, much bigger when they were erect. Big doinks, Simon said, never grew much when they got hard. I confess, I don't know. I have no doink theory, as adamant or hopeful as Simon's. The only time I saw Owen Meany with an erection, he was wrapped in swaddling clothes. He was only an 11-year-old baby Jesus, and although his hard-on was highly inappropriate, it didn't strike me as astonishing. As for the shot, Owen and I were guilty of lack of practice. By the end of our freshman year, by the summer of 1963, when we were 21, the legal drinking age at last, we had trouble sinking the shot in under 5 seconds. We had to work at it all summer, just to get back to where we had been, just to break 4 seconds again. It was the summer the Buddhists in Vietnam were demonstrating. They were setting themselves on fire. It was the summer when Owen said,
"What's a Catholic doing as president of a country of Buddhists?"
It was the summer when President Diem was not long for this world. President John F. Kennedy was not long for this world either. And it was the first summer I went to work for Meany Granite. It was my illusion that I worked for Mr. Meany. It was his illusion, too. It had been amply demonstrated to me who bossed whom in that family. I should have known from the start that Owen was in charge.
"My father wants to start you out in the monument shop," he told me. "You begin with an understanding of the finished product. In this business, it's easier to begin with the fine-tuning. It's getting the stuff out of the ground that can be tricky. I hope you don't think I'm condescending, but working with Granite is a lot like writing a term paper. It's the first draft that can kill you. Once you get the good stuff into the shop, the fine work is easy. Cutting the stone, edging the letters. You've just got to be fussy. It's all smoothing and polishing. You've got to go slowly. Don't be in a hurry to work in the quarries. At the monument end, at least the size and weight of the stone are manageable. You're working with smaller tools and a smaller product. And in the shop, every day is different. You never know how busy you'll be. Most people don't die on schedule. Most families don't order gravestones in advance.
I don't doubt that he was genuinely concerned for my safety. And I know he knew everything about Granite. It was wise to develop a feeling for the stone, on a smaller, more refined scale, before one encountered the intimidating size and weight of it in the quarry. All the quarrymen, the signalman, the derrickmen, the channel bar drillers and the dynamiters, and even the sawyers who had to handle the rock before it was cut down to monument size, all the men who worked at the quarries, were afforded a less generous margin for error than those of us who worked in the monument shop. Even so, I thought there was more than caution motivating Owen to keep me working in the monument shop for the entire summer of 63. For one thing, I wanted muscles, and the physical work in the monument shop was a lot less strenuous than being a logger for my Uncle Alfred. For another thing, I envied Owen his tan. He worked in the quarries, unless it was raining. On rainy days, he worked in the shop with me. And we called him in from the quarries whenever there was a customer placing an order for a gravestone. Owen insisted that he be the one to handle that. And when the order was not placed by a funeral home, when the customer was a family member or a close friend of the deceased, we were all grateful that Owen wanted to handle it. He was very good at that part of it, very respectful of grief, very tactful, while at the same time he managed to be very specific. I don't mean that this was simply a matter of spelling the name correctly and double-checking the date of birth and the date of death. I mean that the personality of the deceased was discussed in depth. Owen sought nothing less than a
proper
monument, a
compatible
monument. The aesthetics of the deceased were taken into consideration. The size, shape, and color of the stone were only the rough drafts of the business. Owen wanted to know the tastes of those mourners who would be viewing the gravestone more than once. I never saw a customer who was displeased with the final product. Unfortunately, for the enterprises of Meany Granite, I never saw very many customers, either.
"Don't be vain,"
Owen told me, when I complained about the length of my apprenticeship in the monument shop.
"If you're standing in the bottom of a quarry, thinking about what kind of tan you're getting, or your stupid muscles, you're going to end up under 10 tons of granite. Besides, my father thinks you're doing a great job with the gravestones."
But I don't think Mr. Meany ever noticed the work I was doing with the monuments. It was August before I even saw Mr. Meany in the shop, and he looked surprised to see me. But he always said the same thing, whenever and wherever he saw me. "Why, it's Johnny Wheelwright," he'd always say. And when it wasn't raining, or when Owen wasn't talking directly to a customer, the only other time that Owen was in the shop was when there was an especially difficult piece of stone cutting assigned, a particularly complicated gravestone, a demanding shape, lots of tight curves and sharp angles and so forth. And the typical Gravesend families were plain and dour in the face of death. We had few calls for elaborate coping, even fewer for archways with dosserets, and not one for angels sliding down barber poles. That was too bad, because to see Owen at work with the diamond wheel was to witness state-of-the-art monument-making. There was no one as precise with the diamond wheel as Owen Meany. A diamond wheel is similar to a radial arm saw, a wood saw familiar to me from my uncle's mill. A diamond wheel is a table saw, but the blade is not part of the table. The blade, which is a diamond-impregnated wheel, is lowered to the table in a gantry.
The wheel blade is about 2 feet in diameter and studded, or tipped, with diamond segments. These are pieces of diamond, only a half inch long, only a quarter inch wide. When the blade is lowered onto the granite, it cuts through the stone at a preset angle into a waiting block of wood. It is a very sharp blade. It makes a very exact and smooth cut. It is perfect for making the precise, polished edges on the tops and sides of gravestones. Like a scalpel, it makes no mistakes, or only the user's mistakes. By comparison to other saws in the granite business, it is so fine and delicate a tool that it isn't even called a saw. It is always called the diamond wheel. It passes through granite with so little resistance that its sound is far less snarly than many wood saws of the power type. A diamond wheel makes a single, high-pitched scream, very plaintive. Owen Meany said,
"A diamond wheel makes the gravestone sound as if the stone itself is mourning."
Think of how much time he spent in that creepy monument shop on Water Street, the unfinished lettering of the names of the dead surrounding him. Is it any wonder that he
saw
his own name and the date of his death on Scrooge's grave? No. It's a wonder he didn't
see
such horrors every day. And when he put on those crazy-looking safety goggles and lowered the diamond wheel into cutting position, the terribly consistent scream of that blade must have reminded him of the permanent scream, which was his own unchanging voice, to use Mr. McSwiney's term for it. After my summer in the monument shop, I could appreciate what might have appealed to Owen Meany about the quiet of churches, the peace of prayer, the easy cadence of hymns and litanies, and even the simplistic athletic ritual of practicing the shot. As for the rest of the summer of 1963, when the Buddhists in Vietnam were torching themselves and time was running out on the Kennedys, Hester was working as a Lobster House waitress again.
"So much for a B.A. in music," she said.
At least I could appreciate what Owen Meany meant when he said of Randy White,
"I'd like to get him under the diamond wheel. All I need is just a few seconds. I'd like to put his doink under the diamond wheel," Owen said.
As for doinks, as for mine in particular, I had another slow summer. The Catholic Church had reason to be proud of the insurmountable virtue of Caroline O'Day, with or without her St. Michael's uniform, and of the virtue of countless others. Any church could be proud. They were all virtuous with me. I felt someone's bare breast, briefly, only once, and it was an accident. One warm night when we went swimming off the beach at Little Boar's Head, and the phosphorescence, in my opinion, was especially seductive. The girl was a musical friend of Hester's, and in the tomato-red pickup on the ride back to Durham, Hester volunteered to be the one to sit on my lap because my date was so displeased by my awkward, amateurish advances.
"Here, you sit in the middle. I'll sit on him," Hester told her friend. "I've felt his silly hard-on before, and it doesn't bother me."
"There's no need to be crude," said Owen Meany.
And so I rode from Little Boar's Head to Durham with Hester on my lap, once again humiliated by my hard-on. I thought that just a few seconds under the diamond wheel would certainly suffice for me, and if someone were to put my doink under the wheel, I considered that it would be no great loss. I was 21, and I was still a Joseph. I was a Joseph then, and I'm just a Joseph now. Georgian Bay, July 27, 1987. Why can't I just enjoy all the nature up here? I coaxed one of the Keeling kids to take me in one of the boats to Pointe aux Barils station. Miraculously, no one on the island needed anything from the station, not an egg, not a scrap of meat or a bar of soap, not even any live bait. I was the only one who needed anything. I needed a newspaper, I'm ashamed to say. Needing to know the news, it's such a weakness. It's worse than many other addictions. It's an especially debilitating illness. The Toronto Star, said the White House was so frustrated by both Congress and the Pentagon that a small special forces group within the military was established, and that actual active-duty American troops fired rockets and machine guns at Nicaraguan soldiers. All this was unknown to the Congress or the Pentagon. Why aren't Americans as disgusted by themselves, as fed up with themselves, as everyone else is? All their lip service to democracy, all their blatantly undemocratic behavior. I've got to stop reading about this whole silly business. All these headlines can turn your mind to mush, headlines that within a year will seem most unmemorable. And if memorable, merely quaint. I live in Canada. I have a Canadian passport. Why should I waste my time caring what the Americans are doing, especially when they don't care themselves? I'm going to try to interest myself in something more cosmic, in something more universal. Although I suppose that a total lack of integrity in government is universal, isn't it? There was another story in the Toronto Star, more appropriate to the paradisiacal view of the universe one can enjoy from Georgian Bay. It was a story about black holes. Scientists say that black holes could engulf two whole galaxies. The story was about the potential collapse of the star system. What could be more important than that? Listen to this. Black holes are concentrations of matter so dense they have collapsed upon themselves. Nothing, not even light, can escape their intense gravitational pull. Imagine that. Not even light. My God. I announced this news to the Keeling family. But one of the middle children, a sort of science prize student, responded to me rather rudely. "Yeah," he said, "but all the black holes are about 2 million light-years away from Earth." And I thought, that is about as far away from Earth as Owen Meany is. That is about as far away from Earth as I would like to be. And where is JFK today? How far away is he? On November 22, 1963, Owen Meany and I were in my room at 80 Front Street studying for a geology exam. I was angry with Owen for manipulating me into taking geology, the true nature of which was concealed, at the University of New Hampshire, in the curriculum catalog under the hippie-inspired title of Earth Science. Owen had misled me into thinking that the course would be an easy means of satisfying a part of our science requirement. He knew all about rocks, he assured me, and the rest of the course would concern itself with fossils.
"It'll be neat to know all about the dinosaurs,"
Owen had said. He seduced me. We spent less than a week with the dinosaurs, and far less time with fossils than we spent learning the horrible names of the ages of the Earth. And it turned out that Owen Meany didn't know a metamorphic schist from an igneous intrusion, unless the latter was granite. On November 22, 1963, I had just confused the Paleocene epoch with the Pleistocene, and I was further confused by the difference between an epoch and an era.
"The Cenozoic is an era, right?" I asked him.
"Who cares?" said Owen Meany. "You can forget that part. And you can forget about anything as broad as the tertiary or the quaternary. That's too broad, too. What you've got to know is more specific. You've got to know what characterized an epoch. For example, which epoch is characterized by the triumph of birds and placental mammals?"
"Jesus, how'd I ever let you talk me into this?" I said.
"Pay attention," said Owen Meany. "There are ways to remember everything. The way to remember Pleistocene is to remember that this epoch was characterized by the appearance of man and widespread glacial ice. Remember the ice. It rhymes with Pleis in Pleistocene."
"Jesus Christ," I said.
"I'm just trying to help you remember," Owen said. "If you're confusing the blossoming of birds and placental mammals with the first appearance of man, you're about 60 million years off. You're making a pretty big mistake."
"The biggest mistake I made was to take geology," I said. Suddenly, Ethel was in my room. We hadn't heard her knock or open the door. I don't remember ever seeing Ethel in my room before, or since.
Your grandmother wishes to see you in the TV room, Ethel said.
Is something wrong with the TV?
Owen asked her.
Something is wrong with the president, Ethel said.
When we found out what was wrong with Kennedy, when we saw him shot, and later, when we learned he was dead, Owen Meany said,
If we first appear in the Pleistocene, I think this is when we disappear. I guess a million years of man is enough.
What we witnessed with the death of Kennedy was the triumph of television. What we saw with his assassination and with his funeral was the beginning of television's dominance of our culture. For television is at its most solemnly self-serving and at its mesmerizing best when it is depicting the untimely deaths of the chosen and the golden. It is as witness to the butchery of heroes in their prime and of all holy-seeming innocence that television achieves its deplorable greatness. The blood on Mrs. Kennedy's clothes and her wrecked face under her veil, the fatherless children, LBJ taking the oath of office, and Brother Bobby looking so very much the next in line.
If Bobby was next in line for Marilyn Monroe, what else is he next in line for?
Said Owen Meany. Not even 5 years later, when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, Hester would say,
Television gives good disaster.
I suppose this was nothing but a more vernacular version of my grandmother's observation of the effect of TV on old people, that watching it would hasten their deaths. If watching television doesn't hasten death, it surely manages to make death more inviting. For television so shamelessly sentimentalizes and romanticizes death that it makes the living feel they have missed something just by staying alive. At 80 Front Street, that November of 63, my grandmother and Owen Meany and I watched the president be killed for hours. For days, we watched him be killed and re-killed again and again.
I get the point, said Owen Meany. If some maniac murders you, you're an instant hero, even if all you were doing is riding in a motorcade.
I wish some maniac would murder me, my grandmother said.
Mrs. Wheelwright, what do you mean?
Owen said.
I mean, why can't some maniac murder someone old, like me? Grandmother said. I'd rather be murdered by a maniac than have to leave my home, and that's what will happen to me, she said. Maybe Dan, maybe Martha, maybe you, she said accusingly to me. One of you, or all of you, either way, you're going to force me to leave this house. You're going to put me in a place with a bunch of old people who are crazy, grandmother said. And I'd rather be murdered by a maniac instead, that's all I mean. One day Ethel won't be able to manage. One day it will take 100 Ethels just to clean up the mess I make, my grandmother said. One day not even you will want to watch television with me, she said to Owen. One day, she said to me, you'll come to visit me, and I won't even know who you are. Why doesn't someone train the maniacs to murder old people and leave the young people alone? What a waste, she cried.
A lot of people were saying this about the death of President Kennedy, with a slightly different meaning, of course.
I'm going to be an incontinent idiot, my grandmother said.
She looked directly at Owen Meany.
Wouldn't you rather be murdered by a maniac? She asked him.
If it would do any good, yes, I would, said Owen Meany.
I think we've been watching too much television, I said.
There's no remedy for that, my grandmother said.
But after the murder of President Kennedy, it seemed to me that there was no remedy for Owen Meany either. He succumbed to a state of mind that he would not discuss with me. He went into a visible decline in communication. I would often see the tomato red pickup parked behind the vestry of Hurd's Church. Owen had kept in touch with the Reverend Lewis Merrill, whose silent and extended prayer for Owen had gained him much respect among the faculty and students at Gravesend. Pastor Merrill had always been liked,
But before his prayer, he had lacked respect. I'm sure that Owen, too, was grateful for Mr. Merrill's gesture, even if the gesture had been a struggle and not of the minister's own initiative. But after JFK's death, Owen appeared to see more of the Reverend Mr. Merrill, and Owen wouldn't tell me what they talked about. Maybe they talked about Marilyn Monroe and the Kennedys. They talked about the dream, I suppose, but I had not yet been successful in coaxing that dream out of Owen Meany. "What's this I hear about a dream you keep having?" I asked him once.
"I don't know what you've heard," he said.
And shortly before that New Year's Eve, I asked Hester if she knew anything about any dream. Hester had had a few drinks. She was getting into her throwing-up mood, but she was rarely caught off guard. She eyed me suspiciously.
"What do you know about it?" she asked me.
"I just know that he has a dream, and that it bothers him," I added.
"I know that it bothers me," she said. "It wakes me up when he has it, and I don't like to look at him when he's having it or after it's over. Don't ask me what it's about," she said. "I can tell you one thing. You don't want to know."
And occasionally, I saw the tomato red pickup parked at St. Michael's, not at the school, but by the curb at the rectory for St. Michael's Catholic Church. I figured he was talking to Father Findlay. Maybe because Kennedy had been a Catholic. Maybe because some kind of ongoing dialogue with Father Findlay had actually been required of Owen, in lieu of his being obliged to compensate the Catholic Church for the damage done to Mary Magdalene. "How's it going with Father Findlay?" I asked him once.
"I believe he means well," Owen said cautiously. "But there's a fundamental leap of faith that all his training, all that Catholic background, simply cannot allow him to make. I don't think he'll ever understand the magnitude, the unspeakable outrage."
Then he stopped talking. "Yes," I said. "You were saying the unspeakable outrage? Was that to your parents, do you mean?"
"Father Findlay simply cannot grasp how they have been made to suffer," said Owen Meany.
"Oh," I said. "I see." I was joking, of course, but either my humor eluded him or else Owen Meany had no intention of making himself any clearer on this point. "But you like Father Findlay?" I asked. "I mean, sort of. He means well, you say. You enjoy talking to him, I guess."
"It turns out it's impossible to restore Mary Magdalene exactly as she was. I mean, the statue," he said. "My father knows a company that makes saints and other holy figures. I mean, granite, you know," he said. "But their prices are ridiculous. Father Findlay's been very patient. I'm getting him good granite and someone who sculpts these saints a little cheaper and makes them a little more personally. You know, not always exactly the same gesture of supplication so that they don't always look like beggars. I've told Father Findlay that I can make him a much better pedestal than the one he's got, and I've been trying to convince him to get rid of that stupid archway. If she doesn't look like a goalie in a goal, maybe kids won't always be taking shots at her. You know what I mean?"
"It's been almost 2 years," I said. "I didn't know you were still involved in replacing Mary Magdalene. I didn't know you were ever this involved," I added.
"Well, someone's got to take charge," he said. "Father Findlay did me a favor. I don't like to see these granite guys taking advantage of him. Someone needs a saint or a holy figure in a hurry, and what do? They make you pay for it. Or they make you wait forever. They figure they've got you by the balls. And who can afford marble? I'm just trying to return a favor."
And was he asking Father Findlay about the dream, I wondered? It bothered me that he was seeing someone I didn't even know, and maybe talking to this person about things he wouldn't discuss with me. I suppose that bothered me about Hester, too. And even the Reverend Lewis Merrill began to irritate me. I didn't run into him very often, although he was a regular in attendance at the rehearsals and performances of the Gravesend Players.
But whenever I did run into him, he looked at me as if he knew something special about me. As if Owen had been talking about me to him. As if I were in Owen's damn dream, or so I imagined. In my opinion, 1964 was not a very exciting year. General Green replaced General Shoup. Owen told me lots of military news. As a good ROTC student, he prided himself on knowing these things. President Johnson ordered the withdrawal of American dependents from South Vietnam.
"This isn't generally an optimistic sign," said Owen Meany.
If the majority of his professors at the University of New Hampshire found Owen less than brilliant, his professors of military science were completely charmed. It was the year when Admiral Sharp replaced Admiral Felt, when General Westmoreland replaced General Harkins, when General Wheeler replaced General Taylor, when General Johnson replaced General Wheeler, when General Taylor replaced Henry Cabot Lodge as U.S. ambassador to Vietnam.
"Lots of stuff is in the works," said Owen Meany.
It was the year of the Tonkin Gulf resolution, which prompted Owen to ask,
"Does that mean the president can declare a war without declaring it?"
It was the year when Owen's grade point average fell below mine. But in military science, his grades were perfect. Even the summer of 64 was uninspired, except for the completion of the replacement Mary Magdalene, which was firmly set upon Owen Meany's formidable pedestal in the St. Michael schoolyard, more than 2 years after the attack upon her predecessor.
"You're so unobservant," Owen told me. "The goalie's been out of the goal for 2 years and you haven't even noticed!"
What I noticed straight away was that he'd talked Father Findlay into removing the goal. The whitewashed stone archway was gone. So was the notion of whitewash. The new Mary Magdalene was granite gray, gravestone gray, a color Owen Meany called
natural.
Her face, like her color, was slightly downcast, almost apologetic, and her arms were not outstretched in obvious supplication. Rather, she clasped her hands together at her slight breast, her hands just barely emerging from the sleeves of her robe, which shapelessly draped her body to her small, bare, plain gray feet. She seemed altogether too demure for a former prostitute, and too withholding of any gesture for a saint. Yet she radiated a certain compliance. She looked as easy to get along with as my mother. And the pedestal upon which Owen had stood her, in contrast to Mary's own rough finish, granite is never as smooth as marble, was highly polished, exquisitely beveled. Owen had cut some very fine edges with the diamond wheel, creating the impression that Mary Magdalene either stood upon or was rising from her grave.
"What do you think?" Owen asked Hester and me. "Father Findlay was very pleased."
"It's sick. It's all sick," said Hester. "It's just death and more death. That's all it is with you, Owen."
"Hester's so sensitive," Owen said.
"I like it better than the other one," I ventured cautiously.
"There's no comparison," said Owen Meany.
"I like the pedestal," I said. "It's almost as if she's, well, you know, stepping out of her own grave."
Owen nodded vigorously.
"You have a good eye," he said. "That's exactly the effect I wanted. That's what it means to be a saint, isn't it? A saint should be an emblem of immortality."
"What a lot of shit," said Hester.
It was an uninspired year for Hester, too. Here she was, a college graduate, still living in her squalid apartment in her old college town, still waitressing in the Lobster House restaurant in Kittery or Portsmouth. I had never eaten there, but Owen said it was nice enough. On the harbor, a little overquaint with the seafood theme, lobster pots and buoys and anchors and mooring ropes were prevalent in the decor. The problem was, Hester hated lobster. She called them insects of the sea, and she washed her hair every night with lemon juice because she thought her hair smelled fishy. I think that her late hours, she waitressed only at night, were in part responsible for Owen Meany's decline as a student. He was loyal about picking her up, and it seemed to me that she worked most nights. Hester had her own driver's license and her own car. Actually, it was Noah's old 57 Chevy, but she hated to drive. That Uncle Alfred and Aunt Martha had given her a hand-me-down might have had something to do with it. In Owen's view, the 57 Chevy was in better shape than his tomato red pickup, but Hester knew it had been second-hand when the Eastmans gave it to Noah, who had passed it to Simon, who'd had a minor accident with it before he'd handed it down to Hester. But by picking up Hester after work, Owen Meany rarely got back to Hester's apartment before 1 o'clock in the morning. Hester was so keyed up after waitressing that she wasn't ready to go to bed before 2. First, she had to wash her hair, which further woke her up, and then she needed to complain. Often, someone had insulted her. Sometimes it had been a customer who'd tried to pick her up, and failing that, had left her a rotten tip. And the other waitresses were woefully unaware, Hester said. What they were unaware of, she wouldn't say, but they often insulted Hester, too. And if Owen Meany didn't spend the night in her apartment, if he drove home to Gravesend, he sometimes didn't get to bed before 3. Hester slept all morning, but Owen had morning classes, or in the summer he was at work very early in the quarries. Sometimes he looked like a tired old man to me, a tired old married man. I tried to nag him into taking more of an interest in his studies, but increasingly he spoke of school as something to get out of.
"When I get out of here," he said, "I've got my active duty to serve, and I don't want to serve it at a desk. Who wants to be in the army for the paperwork?"
"Who wants to be in the army at all?" I asked him. "You ought to sit at a desk a little more often than you do. The way you're going to college, you might as well be in the army already." "I don't understand you. With your natural ability, you ought to be sailing through this place with the highest honors."
"It did me a lot of good to sail through Gravesend Academy with the highest honors, didn't it?"
he said. "Maybe if you weren't a stupid geology major, you could be a little more enthusiastic about your courses," I told him.
"Geology is easy for me," Owen said. "At least, I already know something about rocks."
"You didn't used to do things just because they were easy," I said. He shrugged. "Remember when people dropped out? Remember that? Owen Meany was the first person I ever saw drop out. Hester, of course, was born dropped out. Maybe Owen got the idea from Hester. But I think he was more original than that. He was original and stubborn." I was stubborn, too. 22-year-olds are stubborn. Owen tried to keep me working in the monument shop the whole summer of 64. I said that one whole summer in the monument shop was enough. Either he would let me work in the quarries or I would quit.
"It's for your own good," he said. "It's the best work in the business, and the easiest."
"So maybe I don't want what's easiest," I said. "So maybe you should let me decide what's best."
"Go ahead and quit,"
he said. "Fine," I said. "I guess I should speak to your father."
"My father didn't hire you," said Owen Meany.
Naturally, I didn't quit. But I matched his stubbornness sufficiently. I hinted that I was losing my interest in practicing the shot. In the summer of 64, Owen Meany resembled a dropout in many ways, but his fervor for practicing the shot had reappeared. We compromised. I apprenticed myself to the diamond wheel until August, and that August, when the USS Maddox and the USS Turner Joy were attacked in the Tonkin Gulf, Owen set me to work as a signalman in the quarries. When it rained, he let me work with the sawyers, and by the end of the summer he apprenticed me to the channel bar drillers.
"Next summer, I'll let you try the derrick," he said. "Next August, I'll give you a little dynamite lesson when I get back from basic training."
Just before we began our junior year at the University of New Hampshire, just before the students returned to Gravesend Academy and to all the nation's other schools and universities, Owen Meany slam-dunked the basketball in the Gravesend Academy gym in under 3 seconds. I suggested that the retarded janitor might have started the official scorer's clock a little late, but Owen insisted that we had sunk the shot in record time. He said that the clock had been accurate, that our success was official.
"I could feel the difference in the air," he said excitedly. "Everything was just a little quicker, a little more spontaneous."
"Now I suppose you'll tell me that under 2 seconds is possible," I said. He was dribbling the ball, crazily, in a frenzy, like a speeded-up film of one of the Harlem Globetrotters. I didn't think he'd heard me. "I suppose you think that under 2 seconds is possible," I shouted. He stopped dribbling.
"Don't be ridiculous," he said. 3 seconds is fast enough."
I was surprised. I thought the idea was to see how fast we can get. "We can always get faster," I said.
"The idea is to be fast enough," he said. "The trick is, can we do it in under 3 seconds every time? That's the idea."
So we kept practicing. When there were students in the Gravesend Academy gym, we went to the playground at St. Michael's. We had no one to time us, we had nothing resembling the official scorer's clock in the gym, and Hester was unwilling to participate in our practices. She was no substitute for the retarded janitor. And the rusty hoop of the basket was a little crooked and the net long gone, and the macadam of the playground was so broken up we couldn't even dribble the ball, but we could still practice. Owen said he could
feel
when we were dunking the shot in under 3 seconds. And although there was no retarded janitor to cheer us on, the nuns in the salt box at the far end of the playground often noticed us. Sometimes they even waved, and Owen Meany would wave back, although he said that nuns still gave him the shivers. And always, Mary Magdalene watched over us. We could feel her silent encouragement. When it snowed, Owen would brush her off. It snowed early that fall, long before Thanksgiving. I remember practicing the shot with my ski hat and my gloves on, but Owen Meany would always do it barehanded. And in the afternoons, when it grew dark early, the lights in the nun's house would be lit before we finished practicing. Mary Magdalene would turn a darker shade of gray. She would almost disappear in the shadows. Once, when it was almost too dark to see the basket, I caught just a glimpse of her, standing at the edge of total darkness. I imagined that she resembled the angel that Owen thought he had seen at my mother's bed. I said this to him, and he looked at Mary Magdalene. Blowing on his cold, bare hands, he looked at her very intently.
"No, there's not really any resemblance," he said. "That angel was very busy. She was moving, always moving, especially her hands. She kept reaching out with her hands."
It was the first I'd heard that the angel had been moving, about what a busy angel he thought he'd seen. "You never said it was moving," I said.
"It was moving, all right," said Owen Meany. "That's why I never had any doubt. It couldn't have been the dummy because it was moving," he said. "And in all these years that I've had the dummy has never moved."
Since when, I wondered, did Owen Meany ever have
any doubt?
And how often had he stared at my mother's dressmaker's dummy? He expected it to move, I thought. When it was so dark at the St. Michael's playground that we couldn't see the basket, we couldn't see Mary Magdalene either. What Owen liked best was to practice the shot until we lost Mary Magdalene in the darkness. Then he would stand under the basket with me and say,
"Can you see her?"
"Not anymore," I'd say.
"You can't see her, but you know she's still there, right?"
he would say. "Of course she's still there," I'd say.
"You're sure?"
he'd ask me. "Of course I'm sure," I'd say.
"But you can't see her,"
he'd say, very teasingly.
"How do you know she's still there if you can't actually see her?"
"Because I know she's still there, because I know she couldn't have gone anywhere, because I just know," I would say. And one cold, late fall day, it was November or even early December, Johnson had defeated Goldwater for the presidency, Khrushchev had been replaced by Brezhnev and Kosygin. 5 Americans had been killed in a Viet Cong attack on the air base at Bien Ho. I was especially exasperated by this game he played about not seeing Mary Magdalene, but still knowing she was there.
"You have no doubt she's there?"
he nagged at me. "Of course I have no doubt," I said.
"But you can't see her. You could be wrong," he said.
"No, I'm not wrong. She's there. I know she's there," I yelled at him.
"You absolutely know she's there, even though you can't see her?"
he asked me.
"Yes!"
I screamed.
"Well, now you know how I feel about God," said Owen Meany. "I can't see him, but I absolutely know he is there."
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.